Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, this is Richard Mill from Deal in Kent, and you're listening to the always compelling Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome, folks, to the Tennis Podcast, introduced there by Richard from Deal in Kent, although I detect there a sneaky little lovely lilting Scottish accent. So, yeah, thank you very much, Richard, for that lovely introduction and for calling us compelling, which is definitely what Matt noted down from it. He said, we've got an intro. He's called us compelling. Thank you very much, Matt. How are you doing?
Yes, that is entirely true. That is what I remembered. And I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, as we disclosed last week, David is on his holidays. Happy holidays, David. He's got a tan already. He's wearing sunglasses. There seems to be some sort of microclimate going on in Croatia where it's still summer. Enjoy it, David. It's lovely here. I am wrapped in a heated blanket as we speak. But we don't need you, quite frankly, because as tentatively promised on the last pod, we do indeed, confirmed, have a very special guest for today's show. And that special guest is 10-time WTA Finals champion, Pam Shriver. Pam, thank you for being with us. How are you doing?
Well, thanks for that compelling introduction of me. 10, I mean, thanks to Martina, responsible for sharing all 10 of those doubles titles. Sabatini got in the way in 88 for one singles in the final, but that's okay. Looking forward to this version.
Yeah. Now, look, I know we've got tennis to wrap up from last week. We will cover off all of the tennis that has been happening. We've had Basel, we've had Vienna, we've had Zhuhai. We'll talk about all of that. But I do think we need to start with the WTA Finals in Cancun and the build-up to the WTA Finals. As we come to you now, we've had one day or one night of action. That means two singles matches, two doubles, with more to come tonight from the group stages. But I think we need to kind of start bigger picture than the actual tennis and kind of the whole setup, the stadium not being ready on time, quite frankly, and the comments coming from the players pre-tournament to the effect that they're not happy. They're not happy with the state of affairs just days before one of the biggest tournaments on the WTA calendar. We've had Arina Sabalenka complaining in her pre-tournament press conference about the situation and then doubling down with a very strong statement on Instagram after her victory last night over Maria Sakkari, 6-love, 6-1, incidentally, that victory. An incredible performance from her to kick things off. But she said, I'm happy that I was able to stay focused tonight, overcome the conditions and play well. I have to say, though, that I'm very disappointed with the WTA and the experience so far at the WTA Finals. As I said in my press conference, as a player, I really feel disrespected by the WTA. I think most of us do. This is not the level of organisation we expect for the finals. To be honest, I don't feel safe moving on this court a lot of the time. The bounce is not consistent at all, and we weren't able to practice on this court until yesterday for the first time. It's just not acceptable to me with so much on the line and so much at stake. All that said, I definitely want to show my appreciation for the local tournament organisers, everyone that built the court at the last minute, and everyone that's working here at the event. I know it's not their fault, and I want them to know, as well as the Mexican fans, that I love them and appreciate them. I'm very happy to be in Mexico. I'm just upset with the WTA and the situation. And Ons Jabeur, who is yet to play, she'll play tonight as we record. And she, of course, is a member of the PTPA, the recently-ish set-up Players Union. She expressed a similar sentiment in her pre-tournament press conference. She said, "I'm not very happy that this is the first day we hit on the stadium. This is such a big event. We should have been able to be ready and hit on the court. Hopefully, this will never, ever, ever happen again, like ever." And while I appreciate the nod to Taylor Swift's Red era there, it's a pretty sorry state of affairs, isn't it? To be going into one of the showpiece events in women's tennis and women's sport, quite frankly, and be having the marquee players, reasonably or not, no matter the extent to which you agree with them or think they're being fair, this is a sorry state of affairs to hear these players talking about their association and one of their biggest tournaments in this way. It's a bummer, Pam.
It definitely is. I was just doing some reflecting as Catherine, you were reading, because I knew there was a lot of comments and posts about the lack of proper preparation. And I suppose when you turn back to the US Open, when we still didn't know where it was going to be, I guess we're not all that surprised. Mexico dealt with a horrendous hurricane last week. It hit the other side. I can imagine if you were the family that's been so amazing to women's tennis the last few years, especially since COVID. I refer to them as Gus Sr. and Gus Jr., the father, son. They're sort of at the core of this family that's helped put on, you know, Guadalajara, both at a lower level, a 1,000 level, the WTA Tour Champions 2 years ago. I mean, this is a family that's put it out on the line. They didn't mean for it to be like this either, I'm sure. So it's sad. But at the same time, I want to recall Madison Square Garden 1 year. We did not have one bit of practice before match time on the match court, because the Garden, you know, hosts the Knicks and the, as well as the NHL Rangers and concerts. And so there was a time when this event was in its absolute peak, when it was at Madison Square Garden, where there was no preparation on the match court. So this has happened before. I guess it tests being professional, but having unsafe conditions once they do get out there to play matches, now that starts to get really uncomfortable. So I feel you can't fix it now, right? There's no way to right the ship. It's just brutal. So we'll see who mentally can deal with it all, and that's who's going to win it.
I think Pam's words there saying this has happened before is probably what strikes me the most about this. Obviously, Pam's referred there to the specific incident at Madison Square Garden of not being able to practice leading into the event. I'm more talking about this feels like 3 years in a row, really, where the WTA Finals has been a bit of a letdown of an event. I think 2 years ago in Guadalajara, they got very lucky because it was still a very late decision to announce to have it there, but it ended up being, you know, there were really good vibes, and I think they were helped by the fact that Paolo Belloso and Garbiñe Muguruza were in the field, and there was this sort of Hispanic connection, and there was, you know, it was a good tournament, but the preparation for it was not ideal either. It wasn't ideal for fans. They didn't know where it was going to be. Last year, we had a similar situation where the decision to hold it in Fort Worth in Texas was just arrived at so late, and it was this cavernous arena, and there were barely any fans there, and it all felt like this big letdown. And then yesterday I turned on the singles matches, and again I just felt like, oh, this doesn't feel like the premium WTA event that it should be. And, you know, I'm very much part of the camp over the years that the ATP Finals, for example, needed to move on from London. You know, I felt like that event was ready for a new home, but there's no doubt about it that having an established home it was a massive deal. Every time you went to that event, it felt big, it felt premium, and it still feels premium in Turin. And the WTA, it's hard to disagree with those strong words from Sabalenka. There were extenuating circumstances, which we all understand, but the fact of the matter is that a few years in a row now, the WTA elite players have been let down by this event. And Anton Dubrov, Sabalenka's coach, posted on Instagram that, you know, there was only a couple of practice courts. They weren't able to practice on the main stadium. There was only one stringer available. It's just doesn't feel like the event of the WTA calendar, which is what it absolutely is and what it should feel like. And it's just such a shame.
Well, and I think it's good you put into perspective the 2 years leading up to this year, because it's not Cancun in a vacuum. It's Cancun, as you mentioned, Fort Worth last year. I was able to work for Tennis Channel, both Fort Worth and the Guadalajara week 2 years ago. And then, of course, 3 years ago, they didn't have it. Mm. So it's I kind of, once you sort of mention that, Matt, as well, I'm like, okay, the players can't keep this private. They can't. One of my things was, we tried sometimes during my era not to air all the dirty laundry and try to get things done privately. But obviously there's such frustration year after year now. So I guess I'm like, okay, players, you got to use your platform, use your voice. It hurts to see the WTA just, given I know this, the amount of money they paid out to try and make the tour go on during COVID, all the financial issues. It's like, it's very complicated. It can't even be summed up in like 2 or 3 minutes. It's so complicated during this particular 4 to 5 year window. Crazy.
And one of my instincts in a situation like this is to cut the WTA some slack, because nobody would like to put on a premium event a la Turin more than they would, right? Nobody would love broadcast rights for women's tennis to be valued as highly by broadcasters and by the public as men's tennis than the WTA, right? I realise they're dealing with a world that doesn't value women's sport the way it should. And they would love to have the marketing budget that the ATP have. They should have the marketing budget that the ATP have. But we as a people don't allow that to happen, right? Because of the value that not any individual, but we as a society place on women and women's sports relative to men. That's not something that's going to be fixed overnight. So I'm always conscious that that is the situation that the WTA are dealing with. And yet I can't, that's not a free pass, right? The fact that that is the situation puts extra onus on those that do have a platform and a prominence within women's sport to make the best of it, to show it off as the incredible product that it is. And I can't help but feel that this isn't the best of a bad situation. I feel like there has to be some mismanagement here, and that doesn't mean that people aren't doing their best and don't have the best of intentions, but I don't know where to point the fingers, because I don't know that, as you say, Pam, it's so complicated. And it's no surprise to me that it was right down to the wire to get the stadium ready. You know, the destination was only decided 6 weeks ago. There's a part of me that thinks, well done for getting it ready. that's not the issue, is it? The issue is, as you described, Matt, you turn it on and it doesn't feel like a premium event. This doesn't feel like something you go, wow, I want to watch this. This clearly matters and is important and is worthy of my time and attention, in a world where there's lots of things trying to grab your time and attention. And that is, it's such a desperate shame, isn't it? And add on to that the potential injury risk, which Sabalenka refers to. I mean, look, time will tell with that, won't it? But just fingers crossed on that front.
And sort of big picture, what's also slightly depressing about all this is it does feel like the solution to those sort of facilities problems and the solution to not knowing where the venue is going to be just a few weeks out, and the sort of end game for all this in terms of all the noises that we're hearing is that this event may end up going to Saudi Arabia. And of course, that will solve a lot of the issues that the players are having. I'm sure the facilities there will be sort of first class, and all the hospitality and everything will be amazing, and they will be treated very well. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I would like to see some of the players apply some of the same energy that they're bringing to bringing up the problems with the staging of this event here, and maybe tackle some of the bigger issues that would be in play if the sport did choose to hold the premium WTA event in Saudi Arabia. And they all skirted that question pretty much at the US Open when the reports were happening. And obviously, it is totally a hypothetical at the moment, but it does sound like that could potentially happen in the future. And yeah, I always like it when players speak up, and I hope they will speak up not only about their own sort of working conditions, but also on some bigger picture issues if the sport does end up going to Saudi Arabia.
If the rumours are to be believed, Saudi Arabia was earmarked as the destination for the finals this year, and it was in part due to some of your colleagues, Pam, your counterparts, speaking out in opposition to the finals going to Saudi Arabia, Martina and Chrissy most notably, that at least put pause on the WTA's plans. Now, I say rumours, you know, John Wertheim in particular was reporting this, one of your colleagues at the Tennis Channel, so pretty, you know, substantiated rumours. How do you feel about the finals potentially going to that destination?
Well, I'm not happy. I've gone on the record. I just see the global leading sport for women for 50 years in professional sports, really since US Open in 73, we just celebrated 50 years of equality that started the ball rolling towards having all four majors be equal. And but at this point, given all the complications everywhere you turn, whether it's China, whether it's other parts of the world, who can bring this tournament up to the premier status? It's like, is that what we have to do? We have to go to Saudi Arabia to make that happen? I just kind of pause and I just like shake my head, because I feel like there's got to be a better way. But I mean, the reason we're in this situation is exactly right. I think they thought this, some people in the WTA thought this year's championship would already be in Saudi Arabia, and then they realized that couldn't happen. So it's a mess. It's an absolute mess, and I don't know how to. There's some messes it's really hard to clean up, and I have this every week now as a parent of three teenagers. There's some messes that are hard to clean up, and I don't know how you clean this up.
Let's get the other mess out of the way before we talk about the tennis, shall we? This is a slightly more fun mess, I think, and it is the what do they call it? The iconic photo. The iconic finals photo. They do this every year. The ATP finals do it as well. Of course, easy for men. Pop them in a suit. Boom. Done.
Although there was one year, wasn't there, in London, where they just gave up and sort of did the official photo in a sort of
dungeon. It was the last year,
dungeon.
Wasn't it? It was in a dungeon, and some of them were in sort of casual wear. Yeah. Yeah, but generally speaking,
especially I think that piece of work, wasn't that piece of work Medvedev? I think he was pretty casual. Sorry, I didn't mean to throw in my piece of work. Go ahead.
So, iconic photo shoot. Generally speaking, you have the 8 singles players and the 16 doubles players, and everybody's quite glammed up. Generally, it's sort of cocktail dress or ball gown territory. Obviously, the venue for this finals is its beach vibes. My understanding was that the tournament were very keen on an all-white dress code. It's a bit of a thing in Mexico, I believe. But obviously, quite short notice, quite difficult. Possibly for players to source a white outfit at short-ish notice. So I believe what happened was the all-white dress code was issued, and then at the last minute there was somewhat of a softening of that dress code to allow a bit of flexibility and a bit of leeway to any players that were struggling to conform to the original dress code. And what we ended up with was, well, Matt, what did we end up with?
We ended up with 7 players in white and Iga Świątek standing out in a red dress, just on her own in red.
Yep. And again, I've made some inquiries. Again, my understanding is that she was fine about it. You know, it was a bit of a joke among the players. And look, if that's me and I show up to an event in literally the opposite of the prescribed dress code, in fact, I'm having a very triggering memory. This precise thing has happened to me. I'm running home and I'm crying myself to sleep. Like there's no way I'm saying, sure, let's proceed with the photo shoot. So good on Iga Świątek for being a good sport and looking perfectly happy in those photos and apparently being perfectly happy. But it looks blooming weird, doesn't it, Pam? It just looks weird.
Yeah, it does. It looks like almost like an exclamation point in the middle of a sentence when it's not even the end of the sentence. And you know, I don't know. It's funny. I had a little tip off that something like this was happening because a good friend of mine who lives here in LA, who's worked as a physical therapist on the WTA tour for over 30 years, we were talking and she's like, I can't figure out what nice white outfit to bring. I go, well, what do you mean like a nice white outfit? I'm like, why does it have to be white? And she's like, well, they've told us we have to wear all white. And that's all I knew. I was like, are you talking about on the court when you go out for treatment? They were like, no. And then I realized it was a party. And then when I saw the photo, I'm like, whoa, it wasn't just the players. It was like the whole party. Everybody was supposed to be wearing white. So then I Googled what's going on with all white parties in Mexico. And I found there is like, you know, these things that happen. And I don't know. It's just, oh, well, I guess in the scheme of all the mess ups, the scarlet dress is fine.
That's it, isn't it? Like, if this is something that's happening, if this is like one sort of funny blip in an otherwise beautifully smooth tournament, it's just that, it's a funny blip. But in context, it ends up looking like a metaphor for the mess that is potentially unfolding. But look, we're a day in. There are still 7 days to go, and there is potential for some fantastic tennis because it's an awesome field. I really think, look, it's a real shame Karolina Muchová has had to withdraw, and we will watch that injury situation eagerly because it's been one of the delights of 2023 that she has been able to be a regular factor at the top of the game. So that is a shame, but that aside, I really think this is an awesome field. It's an awesome draw. Look, however they'd fallen, it would have been an awesome draw. But what we've ended up with is the Bacala group. Pronunciation, verification, Matt?
Sounds good.
And translation? What is a Bacala?
I believe it's a municipality or area in Mexico, because I was also confused.
Okay, right. Great, thank you. The Bacala group is the world number one, Aryna Sabalenka. And by the way, that number one ranking is up for grabs. There's a tussle between Sabalenka and Świątek this week. So Sabalenka, Rybakina, Pegula and Sakkari. And that's the group that has already kicked off. Pegula beat Rybakina last night 7-5, 6-2. She won 10 of the last 12 games after Rybakina served for the first set at 5-3. A really erratic performance from Rybakina, 35 unforced errors over those two sets. And then we also had, as I mentioned earlier, Sabalenka beating Sakkari, who's coming as the alternate for Muchová, 6-love, 6-1. She had 3 match points for a double bagel there. And the other group is the Chetumal group, which is Iga Świątek, Coco Gauff, Ons Jabeur and Markéta Vondroušová. And they kick off tonight. Pegula, Rybakina, Matt. What did we think?
Felt a bit like Rybakina was feeling the pressure of being bumped onto the backhand list, to be honest, because that that shot was not good. It was my first chance to watch her since putting her on my list, and well, I was a bit disappointed, I have to say. She started well in this match. You know, she was the one who took the lead, as you said, and her serve was really jumping up off the court. It's a very bouncy court, and it was really taking the kick on her serve well. And I thought, okay, this looks like maybe good conditions for Rybakina. But then, well, she got broken five times after that. And that has been a bit of a theme for Rybakina over the last few months, having that brilliant serve, one of the best serves in the game, not being able to protect it and having it broken a lot. It's something that certainly wasn't happening to her at the start of the season, but has been happening a lot recently. And Pegula seemed to get used to the court, used to the speed of it, and just did what Pegula does and played a very good, solid match without being spectacular. But I was pleased for her because last year she had an absolutely terrible time in Fort Worth, losing all of her singles and doubles matches. And it felt like, you know, she needed another go at this event because she was out of steam last year, whereas this year she came in a little bit fresher. She's unbeaten in singles in Mexico, having won the WTA 1000 event there in Guadalajara in the past. So I know we're not at sea level, we're not at altitude in Cancun like they are in Guadalajara, but it does seem like she likes the atmosphere, she likes the vibe in Mexico. So really good start for Pegula, but I don't know, Rybakina, it strikes me that there's maybe a bit of a battle for number one going on, but kind of a bit of a battle for sort of player of the year as well. And I guess I'm mainly looking at the major champions there, you know, and especially Świątek and Sabalenka. They feel like the two best players of the year, but Rybakina was right there with them at the start of the year. You know, we went early, but we were talking about the big three, and Rybakina was part of that conversation. And she hasn't won a title since the clay court swing, I don't think, and just feels like there's been a bit of a drop-off in level and performance from her, and I think we saw that sort of inconsistency yesterday against Pegula.
And Matt, you brought up the serve, right? We know how important that is for Rybakina, and just looking at the numbers, if you just saw the numbers and you didn't know which number belonged to which player, first serve points won. One player was at 80%, that's 24 of 30, and the other player at 55.6, just 20 of 36. You might think going in that Pegula would have the lower number, but Rybakina, just 55%. And so definitely having a problem on serve, you can consider the strength of it at the beginning of the year, but I just want to go back to Pegula. She may be the one that emotionally, mentally can kind of deal with all that's going on in Cancun and the lack of what everybody else is complaining. And let's just see what Pegula, who has such great emotional IQ, both on and off the court. Let's see if she isn't there, or Coco, the two Americans, to like reel in this title.
She's also on the player council, isn't she, Jessica Pegula? I get the impression she's a real diplomat behind the scenes. So she kind of has, like, if she is frustrated and angry, you know, whatever, she's kind of got an outlet for all of those emotions and a way to feel like she can do something about it rather than just sort of being pent up and irritated. I feel like that's probably quite a healthy place to be. And it's an interesting one with Pegula and Goff having counted themselves out early of the Billie Jean King Cup finals. And I'm sure that would have been a wrench for them. But as gutted as I am for the Billie Jean King Cup, I get it. After the experience of last year and the turnaround time wise and geographically being potentially even more whiplash inducing this year, I totally understand why they've had to make that choice. But you know, it is a statement of intent. It is they've sacrificed something quite big in order to focus on these WTA finals, and yeah, it kind of puts them at the singles and the doubles title for both of them and success in those, it puts it at even more of a premium, I think. Sorry, Matt, I thought you were nodding like I've got something to say, but it was just...
I was just nodding, great point.
Yeah. So what matches do we have tonight, Matt, from the Chetumal group? We have Świątek against...
Vondroušová.
And we have Goff against Jabeur. Okay. Would anybody care to make predictions for the WTA finals? It's tough, isn't it? Because we've seen four of them play. We haven't seen the other group play yet, but I'll take predictions anyway.
I think the woman in red is going to be also hard to beat. I think Świątek, I actually like her response overall since losing the number one ranking, seeing Coco Gauff win the US Open. I feel like Iga may not win it, but I think she's going to play well. Vondroušová, who knows? I'm never going to count her out again after what she did at Wimbledon, but I don't see Vondroušová winning this championship. I think Coco Gauff is the other fascinating one. I think in this era, to see how players play in the months after they win a major is really interesting. And, you know, Pegula got the win that they were 0 for 6 last year, 0 for 12 if you combine both Gauff's and Pegula's record. But now it's Gauff's turn. And I think if Gauff can beat Jabeur, I think your winners will be either Świątek, Pegula, or Gauff. That's almost half the field, Pam.
This is real replacing David. You've done well.
Outrageous. Look, if I had shown up in a red cocktail dress to a party with the dress code of white smart casual, I would think, oh my god, I simply have to go and win the tournament now. That's the only. That's the only way I can rescue this week. Mm. So I'm going to go Świątek.
I'll give a nod to Laura Robson on commentary last night here in the UK, because she was talking about the conditions, and she was saying that actually she feels like those conditions and that court can actually suit everyone in the field. And this was during the first match. And then she said, except Sakkari. I think it's going to be really bad for Sakkari. And then, of course, Sakkari gets blown out and only wins one game in the match. So I think that sounds like a good call from Laura Robson there. And look, I think that's a very compelling point that you've made about the sort of calmness of Jessica Pegula versus clearly how frustrated Aryna Sabalenka is. And I feel like Sabalenka would be my pick. I feel like fast conditions where she can kind of dominate opponents, it would be on her racket. But if she's frustrated, which she clearly is, that doesn't feel conducive necessarily to playing her best tennis. And I thought she was okay against Sakkari, but really Sakkari was just a non-factor in that match. I didn't think Sabalenka quite even had her best tennis despite the scoreline. I'm pretty convinced by Świątek post US Open and the way she won the title in Beijing. She's drawn Gauff again in the group. Those two are, it's like a moth to a flame. Those two, they always seem to be next to each other in the draws and playing each other. I'm fascinated to see that match up again. Iga Świątek would be my favourite.
They're the Alex de Minaur and Andy Murray of women's tennis. Sorry, I didn't mean to trigger anyone with that reference. The doubles in Cancun is the Mahahual group, which features Jessica Pegula and Coco Gauff, Krejcikova, Siniaková, Zvonareva, Siegmund and Dobrowski, Routliff.
So that means we get Siegmund Gauff, which I'm excited about.
Yes. Yes. Excellent pick, Matt. They got work to do already, Gauff and Pegula, because they lost their opener last night to Routliff Dobrowski, 7-6, 6-3. Then we have the Maya Khan group, which features Hunter Mertens, Aoyama Shibahara, Scherz and Kravchik, and Melikar Martinez and Perez. And that kicked off with Shibahara and Aoyama beating Scherz and Kravchik, 7-5, 6-3. So the fact that we've got Gauff and Pegula in opposing singles groups, but obviously in the same doubles groups, means I think there's going to have to be some nifty scheduling. Well, I mean, there's already been some nifty scheduling, hasn't there? Because we've had one doubles match from each group. So Yeah, we'll try and keep on top of all of that. And interestingly, the doubles players, sorry to keep coming back to the clothes, the doubles players all were in screaming colour at the they'd got the same memo as Iga Świątek for the photo. Strange. Anyway.
I didn't get any memo. I didn't get any invitation, no memo, nothing. That's why I'm wearing my Australian Open orange sweatshirt here with Bugs Bunny.
It's making me excited for the Australian Open, Pam. I love it. Not that I wasn't already excited, but doubly so.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We move on to Zhuhai, and this is the portion of proceedings during which I am most delighted that you are here instead of David, Pam, because David would quite frankly be insufferable if he was here, because his big Beatrice Haddad Maia prediction has finally come off a year and a half late, but he predicted Beatrice Haddad Maia, or Haddad Maia, I believe we should be calling her. I believe that's the correct pronunciation. She won not only the singles title at the WTA Elite Trophy in Zhuhai, but the doubles as well. The doubles alongside Veronika Kudermetova, they beat Kato and Tsutiyadi 6-3, 6-3 in that final, and she beat Zhongxin Wen 7-6, 7-6 in a cracking singles final. That, I mean, it was already fantastic, but if Zhongxin Wen had just been fully fit for that, I really think it could have been an all-timer. It had just all the makings of an absolute epic. But she got herself over the line, hauled herself over the line, did Haddad Maia, and that was after having beaten Madison Keys, Caroline Garcia, Daria Kazatkina in the group stages. I mean, it in the words of David Law, I'm loath to quote him or reference him any more than is strictly necessary in this portion, but these might just be results, and I'm referring to Haddad Maia and Zhongxin Wen here. These might be results at this time of year that really do have relevance for next year. I really do feel, and I know we have said this before countless times, we've been here before, but I really do feel like Haddad Maia and Zhongxin Wen can use this as a platform and a springboard and do, cue very vague prediction here, do big things in 2024. Discuss, Pam.
Well, I've watched very little tennis since the US Open concluded, but the most tennis that I have watched since was actually Zhuhai. It's a tournament Donna Vekic was able to slide in. I watched Donna lead 4-2 in the final set against Zhang Qinwen in the first round. So I watched that match pretty closely. I think with Zhang Qinwen has raised the level of her game incredibly. I think she's dealt with a loss of win to set as her coach to the Osaka camp. There's an example of turning adversity and flipping it to a positive. And I don't know her well, but I give her a lot of credit for that. I was lucky this year about 3 or 4 times Donna practiced with Beatrice Hadajmaya, and I'm so impressed by her work ethic, her fitness, her team. Very, very professional, as most teams are. And look, being a lefty, this is what Navratilova did time and time again. Win a year-ending championships. I know it was the second year championship, but to win singles and doubles in 2023, I just give it up. And what a huge payday. I believe I saw, if you ran the table in singles, it was, because I looked at it for Donna in case she ran the table, $650,000. I think it's like $650,000. Not including the doubles. So this changes her life, her year. And I do agree with her lefty game, having gotten to semis and pushed Iga at Roland Garros. I think David's prediction, it's possible in the next 2 years that she could win a major.
Wow.
Silence?
More possible, if you had to pick one of Zhang Qinwen and Beatrice Hadajmaya.
In her career, I'd go Zhang Qinwen. In the next 2 years, I might take the big lefty from Brazil.
Interesting.
I find her utterly compelling, Hadajmaya, because even as much as I've watched her now, every time when I start watching her, I still expect her to hit bigger than she does. I expect her to be a different type of player just from the look of her. But she's not. She's such a street fighter, isn't she? She's Sara Cerebes Tormo in the body of Lindsay Davenport. And look, she does have a big hit on her. It's almost like Gael Monfils, who does have big weapons, but that's just not the type of tennis that he wants to play. He wants to play more kind of Andy Murray style of tennis. I find her really interesting for other reasons as well, but she kind of always catches me off guard.
And I do wonder whether that's an improvement, an evolution that she maybe does need to make in order to become a major champion, because it's incredible the way she battles through so many tough matches, but they do take their toll. And that was something in Zhuhai last week. I think one of the reasons David picked Beatrice Hadajmaya to win that tournament was because he had a little bit of inside information, having spoken to her on the eve of that tournament, and he said that she seemed really fresh and ready for that tournament. And I think the end of season is a tournament where, you know, some players are limping across the finish line, aren't they? And she was ready. And I think maybe one of the reasons she was ready was something that was quite low key but really horrific. Was she suffered a terrible hand injury in Guadalajara, I don't know, it was 6 weeks ago or so, in the shower.
A shower incident.
Yeah, I think it kind of like exploded on her, and it was burns, I think, on her hand. And she started the Asian swing with tape on her hands because she still wasn't sort of fully recovered from that. Didn't do particularly well and didn't win too many matches, but consequently arrived in Zhuhai with maybe a little bit of freshness, a bit of a feeling of, I don't know, luck perhaps, that it wasn't worse and that she was able to play and compete. And that sort of carried her through, and it was really noticeable in Zhuhai how efficiently she was winning compared to a lot of matches that I associate with her. You know, it was a real battle in the final. It was a straight set to win, but it was 3 hours. But before then, she'd been pretty dominant in her matches, and that felt like a slight elevation from her. And it feels like she needs to do that if she's going to win a major. And she's capable because she's such a good competitor, and she's also got a, you know, got weapons, got a good game, got that lefty awkwardness. And it would be great to see, because I think she could do really big things for tennis in that region of the world as well, if she does continue to have great results. Because we saw the amazing support that she got at Roland Garros this year, and I'd love to see that around the world as well. And I think Zheng Qinwen did just totally hit the wall. All of her matches were three setters, and she was playing with a bandaged leg, but she's made big improvements in the last few weeks as well. And I feel like the ceiling of her game is so high, and watching her unlock her own talent is going to be such a fun thing to watch over the next few years, I hope.
Those are all great points, Matt, but all I've just heard is accusation of insider trading against David Law and his prediction this week. Do we need to introduce a new rule? That was also a little teaser for an upcoming episode of Tennis Relived, by the way, that Matt's just dropped there, that, like a little Easter egg. Love that. How did Donna find Zhuhai, Pam? Like, are you a fan of that event? It didn't used to exist in your day, right?
I know. New, and
it's like a plate in tournament form, right?
you're asking that to the 1986 winner of the plate at Wimbledon.
I've seen your plate,
title.
Pam. I've held
That's
that
right,
plate.
I forgot. I actually think it's a pretty cool event. I hadn't watched it that much through the years. I had an interest to watch it this year. Donna didn't think she'd get she got one of the last invites, and after a pretty bad Asian swing where Donna only won one match and a couple of tournaments, went all the way back to Europe and was home like 3 or 4 days, and then got the confirmation that she had gotten in. I think Lynette and Vekic were the last two in because they had the wild card go to Zhu Lin. And Donna was very extremely happy with, you know, if she went on a streak, she could win $650,000. So got herself back to China and ended up saying that the tournament did a really good job. So I thought the crowd seemed good. I think the excitement of having a couple of Chinese players in it, and one obviously with a great chance to win, I think that helped. And look at who's won that tournament in the past. I think Barty's won it. Venus Williams has won it. So why not?
And there was a time, wasn't there, where it used to follow the WTA finals, and that always felt wrong. You know, it just felt like completely the wrong way around. But I think it was much better this year that it preceded it. And yeah, I thought it was a really good week there.
So while the WTA was in Zhuhai, the ATP were in Vienna and Basel this week. The Vienna title was won by Jannik Sinner, beating Daniil Medvedev in an awesome final. 3 hours, 7-6, 4-6, 6-3. En route to that final, he had also beaten Tokyo champion Ben Shelton, Lorenzo Sonego, Francis Tiafoe, Andre Rublev. Rublev, incidentally, by reaching the semifinals, sealed his qualification for Turin. It was an awesome week for Jannik Sinner, who not only is putting together these fantastic results, but also, quite crucially, given how much you'd expect them to play over coming years, seems really to have turned what was a catastrophic head-to-head, a matchup against Daniil Medvedev, turned it around completely. And that feels amazing to me, having watched their final in Miami this year from courtside, thinking he's just got no chance. The game does not work. He doesn't have a good enough drop shot. He doesn't have enough variety in his game to exploit the weaknesses of Daniil Medvedev. Well, that is so far from the truth now. And that was only 6 months ago. It's really impressive stuff, I think, from Jannik Sinner, Matt.
Yes, I have been so impressed with him in Beijing and again in Vienna. It's kind of like a home tournament for him almost. You know, he's born in that part of Italy, which is right on the Austrian border. And it felt like, you know, he really wanted to win it. He was receiving a lot of support there. And I think the thing about Jannik Sinner is that, you know, for people like us who talk about tennis every week, he's been one of those guys who's been committed to the sort of slow and steady, trust the process improvement. And I think sometimes it can almost feel like maybe he'd been standing still a little bit. But behind the scenes and in the background, I think he had been improving a lot, and he'd got a good team around him, and he'd been improving his physicality. He's much stronger, I think, than he used to be, sort of in his legs as much as anything. And he's done a lot of groundwork. But it does feel like the past couple of tournaments where he's beaten Medvedev and beaten Alcaraz as well, it feels like the biggest sort of surge that he's made in his career, the biggest sort of statement tennis that I've ever seen from Jannik Sinner. And he's been absolutely brilliant to watch, and he's been just an absolute handful for some really, really good players. And what I loved about this final is that he kind of beat Medvedev in two different ways. He was using the variety in the first set, you know, not you know, crazy variety, but occasionally throwing in drop shots and occasionally a slice backhand, and mainly just a commitment to get to the net. He's not, you know, he's not Stefan Edberg up at the net. He's not Pam Shriver up at the net, but he is trying to incorporate that into his game. And I think it worked for him in that first set. But in the third set, he put that away, and he actually kind of out-Medvedev'd Medvedev, and it was grueling rallies from the back of the court that he was winning. He had to come through a 20-minute game at one point, converting his ninth break point, 13th deuce. You know, it was resilient stuff, and I think he just showed a few different sides to himself, which is what you need to be able to win the biggest tournaments and beat the best players in the world. And I've loved seeing this transformation in him over the last couple of weeks. I think I have been guilty of viewing him a little bit through a Carlos Alcaraz lens and being most excited about Jannik Sinner when he's playing Carlos Alcaraz. But he's beating other top players now really consistently, turning that head-to-head round against Medvedev, and just being a great watch. I love watching him just tee off and hit groundstroke winners. It's kind of mesmerizing the way he can do that. And obviously we need to see it at the Slams. I think that's massive for Jannik Sinner in 2024. He needs to bring this level to the Slams, and until he does, there will still be that slight question mark, I suppose. But it really feels to me like he's stepped up in the last few weeks, and I back him to bring this at the Slams now in a way that maybe I didn't in the past. I've been so impressed.
I started watching that match at 2-1. Sorry, just quickly, that 2-1 game, that marathon game, I was then glued to that match for the rest of it, including Medvedev imitating Sinner's, like maybe walking a little bit gingerly, maybe he had an injury. Medvedev was becoming that piece of work again. But just two quick things on why that head-to-head was able to be turned around. Darren Cahill is an expert in everything coaching related, but especially the X's and Y's of figuring out why the head-to-head didn't work for Jannik Sinner prior to the last couple of matches. And then also they use Golden Set data analytics, and they get every possible bit of information from all the other matchups. And I can just imagine how Jannik would have been given the last couple of matches a different head-to-head, and he's such a good athlete, he could carry it out. But that match yesterday was right up there with the best of the year.
I feel like this is kind of a whole offshoot podcast in itself, Pam, but you've just opened up such a rich seam of discussion. I can't help but ask what, and Golden Set isn't the only provider of data analytics, is it, to players? There are a couple of other prominent ones as well, but Golden Set definitely is one of the ones that a lot of players use. What percentage of players, let's say in the top 50, would be using a service like that right now, would you say?
I think most. I think a majority, although the one I've been working with still doesn't want to do it. What I think we might do on the coaching side is just coaches sometimes just get the information and the player doesn't even have to know. If they don't want to deal with that kind of detail or afraid to like open it up, but there's lots of ways you can get it done. And I've been thinking hard on how to help the player I'm trying to help. But I do think, Catherine, it's a majority. It's been one of the biggest changes in the last 5 years. And Djokovic talked about it at length at the US Open on our ESPN set about how long he's been using it. He was, to me, was the really first one to go all in on this. And now, obviously, there's no better example of using analytics, video analysis, everything than Djokovic's success in the last few years.
And with your coaching hat on, I presume you're a fan. You think it's a good development?
I think any tool that you can have that helps the modern athlete, whether it's better mindset training or data analytics, it's kind of like the Navratilova philosophy that I saw up close in the late 70s and 80s. Do not leave one stone unturned. You have to look behind each and everything to try and get the extra 1, 2, 3, 4%, whether it's in a matchup like the Sinner Medvedev or whether it's just generally to know the strengths of your game. So I'm for it, but I haven't been successful in getting Donna to go all in, and I don't think she ever will. So now we have to figure out on the coaching end and still help her with it.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because I guess the way players engage with data analytics must vary wildly. I guess there are some that probably want to sit down and read all the numbers and nerd out on it all, and there are probably some that want to unturn that stone, as it were, but you know, just give me the facts, ma'am. Want their coach to do all the digestion for them and say, you look at the numbers and you tell me what to take from it. Just give me the cliff notes, and I'm sure, you know, players fall at various different points on the spectrum. But yeah, it's so fascinating and probably something that we should probably put on our list of things to look into for future Friends shows. Jannik Sinner, Grand Slam champion 2024, Pam?
I think he's going to get to a final in 2024. I think he'll win one in 2025.
Yeah, he's methodical, isn't he? Tick off the milestones one by one. Over to Basel, where Felix Auger-Aliassime has done what Daniil Medvedev can't do. Daniil Medvedev, incidentally, the hunt for him goes on to repeat win a title, let alone defend one, because that's what Auger-Aliassime has done out of nowhere in Basel. Saved a match point against Alexander Shevchenko in the quarterfinals and thrashed Holger Rune, who, having got some form together at the start of the tournament, was awful in the semis. 6-3, 6-3 for Auger-Aliassime against Rune. And then he beat Hubert Hurkacz in, of course, two tiebreak sets on Sunday, because Hurkacz can only play marathon matches, apparently. I've no idea where, how and why this has come. But I am pleased for Felix Auger-Aliassime, because he had started to look weary. He had started to look weighed down by the experience of 2023, which has been pretty terrible for him, quite frankly, pretty terrible relative to what expectations were at the end of 2022, when he went on that tear at events exactly like this one. He won three back-to-back, didn't he? And we were saying, it's happening! And it just did not happen this year. And this result does not a year make. It doesn't change what's happened this year. It has been thoroughly disappointing for him, but hopefully this will just be a little bit of fuel to his fire of belief. I still have my question marks about his game. I really do. I'm not sure there's enough there in terms of plan B and C to compete with Alcaraz's and Sinner's, but I'm pleased for him, Matt.
Yeah, I think seeing players go through a rut and such a dry spell is always very, very difficult to watch. And on the flip side, seeing them get out of it is kind of one of the best things to witness. And I don't know, like, I'm sure Pam can speak on this, but I do feel that sometimes obviously Medvedev hasn't felt this with his inability to win the same tournament twice, but sometimes it does strike me that players just have places that they like and where they feel good and sort of feel comfortable. And kind of from the off, it just felt like there was something a bit different about Auger-Aliassime this week compared to the way he had been. And it just clicked for him. And I thought he was brilliant in the last two matches. Those were the ones I watched most closely. And you could tell that his confidence level was higher. He was going for shots on his backhand, for example, that he doesn't usually go for. And he was, you know, he's got a game, Auger Aliassime. I completely agree with you that I doubt some of his adaptability and his flexibility and his backup plans. But to me, there's no reason why he can't be a bit like Rublev and have a really good plan A. He's got such a big serve, such a big forehand, and when that's working, he should be able to beat most players. And he just hasn't been able to get that going all season, and he did this week. He said that he never lost belief. He was pretty punchy. He said, "I'm back, but also I've never lost my confidence." But it really felt like he was playing with a lack of confidence throughout the season. And I know he had an injury around the springtime, which maybe lingered and didn't help him. But it was a really different Felix Auger-Aliassime, and I was just very pleased to see it because, yeah, it's been a really, really tough watch for him this season.
I was just going to say, like, when you see players have slumps, and they happen both tours, right, and you don't have a career on the tennis tour without having some of these dips. But this one for Felix this past year, you know, some slumps really feel so uncomfortable. And I felt extremely uncomfortable. So the fact that he was having a breakthrough indoors, the conditions that he loves the most, you know, that's probably where it was going to happen. It wasn't going to be outdoors. And now we'll see, like, is this guy going to be more consistent? I don't know. He's made weird decisions on his team coaching. I still don't understand the Uncle Tony fit. Or why, where that came from. But anyway, such a lovely man. And I hope this gets him to a better, more consistent level, because that was one of the most uncomfortable slumps I've experienced from a distance for a long time.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I agree. He'll move on to Paris, where Alcaraz is back and fit to play. So forget everything I said about my desperate concerns for Carlos Alcaraz and his multi-injury situation last week. He is back, as is Novak Djokovic, playing for the first time since Davis Cup 6 weeks ago. We've already seen, as I mentioned, Alex de Minaur beat Andy Murray again for the sixth straight time. And for the second straight time, I think de Minaur came from 2-5 down, this time a double breakdown saved match point. It's wearying watching Andy Murray at the moment, isn't it? It's a tough watch.
Yeah, I think Katie Bolter summed it up best by just saying, "No more Andy Murray, Alex de Minaur in my life, please, ever again. Thank you." I didn't think it could get more brutal and painful than his match against de Minaur in Beijing, where he was 5-2 up, had multiple match points and lost. And this time he was in that exact situation again, except he was a double break up in that final set rather than just a single break. Served for it twice, had a match point on his own serve. And yeah, it's... Look, I think at this stage in his career, it does feel like there's a bit of a matchup problem for Andy Murray against Alex de Minaur. I don't think it's all in his head, but the end of that match did feel like it was just totally in Andy Murray's head. His level didn't completely fall apart, but he tightened, and you know, it's just uncomfortable to see kind of an all-time great, and I consider Andy Murray an all-time great, get that tight. And I know it happens to kind of everyone as they get older and you get deep into your career, or most players, maybe not Novak Djokovic, but it's really apparent with Andy Murray in this matchup with Alex de Minaur how it seems like his nerve has gone a little bit in those closing stages, and de Minaur knows it, and he just hangs in there and just sort of sneaks past him at the finish line. And yeah, it's been a really tough year for Andy Murray, really, since the start of the season when he was playing so well. I don't think he's won many matches sort of consecutively since then, and I think Wimbledon was just such a huge bummer for him. He was playing really well and he had an opportunity there, and the curfew struck and he didn't quite get over the line against Tsitsipas, and it's been very, very difficult for him ever since. And you know, that might be his season done. Who knows whether he'll be used by Leon Smith at the Davis Cup, but if he is going to be used, his next match will be against Novak Djokovic, so that doesn't feel like much of a consolation.
Yeah, well, just briefly on that, because, you know, we'll be doing plenty of coverage for the Davis Cup finals when they come. Matt's going to be out there in Malaga. He's going to be in Seville as well for the Billie Jean King Cup finals. But Dan Evans suffered a horrendous-looking calf injury mid-match. He was 4-1 up on Francis Tiafo in Vienna. It was one of those injuries where instantly you knew it was game over. Absolutely gutting moment for him. And we do now know, unsurprisingly, that that's his season over. He's out of the Davis Cup finals. He would have been Britain's number two. Cam Norrie on ranking is still Britain's number one, but he's in an awful trough of form. And in the words of your friend and mine, Simon Briggs's piece today, he tweeted, "Shock in Brit tennis circles as Cam Norrie, one of the tour's great troopers, finally takes a holiday." Because citing a knee injury, he's pulled out of Paris, but it does sound like it's burnout as much as it is a knee injury. Now, if Cam Norrie is fit to play and selected, he would play at one in the Davis Cup finals, and he would take on Novak Djokovic. But that is very much an if at this stage. And if Cam Norrie doesn't play, Andy Murray is the top-ranked British man. He plays at one, with probably Jack Draper playing at two. So that is, I mean, it's devastating for Dan Evans, and it's a tough watch. See everything we were saying about Felix Auger-Aliassime and repeat re Cam Norrie. He's been a tough watch recently, but potential interesting state of affairs developing there with the British Davis Cup team, which we will keep an eye on. It is Team Wawrinka tonight, which I'm trying to get excited about, but worry it could be sad. But let's focus on the potential excitement of that. And yeah, I'm excited to see Djokovic and Alcaraz play again. Don't like to go too long without the potential for a Djokovic-Alcaraz match. A couple of other bits of news to wrap up from the week. Jensen Brooksby has received an 18-month ban for 3 whereabouts failures in a 12-month period. The ban will run until January the 4th, 2025. That's the second high-profile case of this season, after a similar thing happened to Mikhail Imer, and he announced his retirement from the sport shortly after. Again, Pam, this is probably worthy of a whole podcast in itself, but where do you come down on this? Maria Sakkari was quite outspoken a while ago, wasn't she, about the onus and the responsibility on players almost being too much with regards to doping and having to cite your whereabouts 365 days a year and not even been able to take supplements or paracetamol if you've got a headache and all of that. But, you know, we know what a challenge it is to keep a clean sport as well, and we all desperately, desperately want that. Where do you come down on this? Is it too much? Are the expectations too much for players?
Well, when I consider where it all started, which was US Open 1988, a month before Seoul Olympic Games, which was after the US Open, and that's when I had my first drug test. That's when tennis first went into the anti-doping official programming. And now when I, again, this is part of my experience of helping Donna in the last 12 months, is really realizing this whereabouts thing, where how you have to administer, and how this is not something you can forget. Like, you have, this has to be a, if you're a professional tennis player, you have to administrate this part of your life. It's almost like nutrition, hydration, sleep, drug testing, administrate. It's just a part of the job. So, okay, if you have some executive functioning organizational issues that make you forget, then have somebody on your team 100% responsible for making sure you do all the reporting you need to do, because otherwise you're going to be in a situation where Brooksby finds himself and Ymer getting out of the sport, forcing him to retire. And people who have two dings waiting for the third, thinking, what if my cell phone goes out? What if the doorbell doesn't ring? What if the hotel calls the wrong room number? Then you're three strikes. Are you at, you know, so don't get to two strikes. Maybe get to one in 12 months because there are errors, but do not get to two or certainly three.
Wimbledon's plans for the park development were approved at a high-tempered Marathon Merton Council planning meeting on Thursday. We don't often report on Merton Council meetings, but here we are. I know that sounds really boring, but this is a really big deal for Wimbledon. I think when plans were first put forward for the development of Wimbledon Park to expand the site of the All England Club and enable Wimbledon not only to have an extra show court across the road, but also to be able to stage qualifying on-site at Wimbledon rather than off-site as they do at the moment. I think when plans were first put forward, you just sort of thought, oh yeah, great idea, sounds brilliant. That'll, you know, Wimbledon are very good at infrastructure projects. This'll be plain sailing, no problem. Look forward to it being unveiled in a few years' time. Well, local residents have had a thing or two to say about it and see the curfew, you know. Local residents have quite a strong say on these matters and they've been presenting quite a blockage, part of which has now been passed. There are still other blockages to be passed. They need the backing of neighbouring Wandsworth Council, which is my council. I've got no say, but there we go. And then it also needs to go to the GLC. It needs to pass through the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. So it's a big first step. There is still more to be overcome. This is the very opposite of plain sailing for Wimbledon. But again, we will follow progress closely. Pam, would you like to hear about our competition winner? Oh, Pam, you've got something to say about Merton Council.
Before the competition, yes, I do. I just want to put in perspective what two of the majors had to go through when their neighborhoods and their clubs didn't present enough opportunity for growth. That was in 77, the last year of the U.S. Open was in Forest Hills. 78, and ever since, Flushing Meadow beside a huge park. And of course, the last year of Kooyong at the Australian Open was 87. 1988 was the first year at Melbourne Park. So the fact that Wimbledon has been able to figure this out while staying in this, you know, historic site where the tournament's been played for, what, 100 years? Matt, you're more the historian, is good for them to figure it out because we know it's not easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck to them. Competition winner, Pam. Would you like to hear about Ed Bowling? Ed is our
100%.
Ed is the winner of our Davis Cup Finals competition. He gets two tickets to the semi-finals on Saturday, the 25th of November in Malaga. He gets a hotel room for two nights, economy flights to and from Malaga. He says, "Dear David, Catherine, Matt, Hannah, and the rest of the Tennis Pod team." He's left Pam out of that list. Terrible, Ed. Terrible. "You have no idea how happy this message made me. Thank you so much, and I'd be absolutely delighted to accept the prize." He says he actually got the message when he was en route to his local tennis club. "Shout out to Linkside LTC in Wanstead, best club in London. And you're all welcome anytime for a hit or a game of doubles." He said, "After going through the usual suspicions of which friend is trying to wind me up here, I was absolutely ecstatic when I realised it was genuine." His favourite player, past and present is Federer for artistry and Enan for grit, though he might be underselling her backhand. And he says, "Present is Sinner for timing and for giving a Sinner Alcaraz, and Ons Jabeur for being a complete magician and lovely person." He's looking forward to full tennis immersion and maybe a cocktail or two in Malaga. And he's going to be bringing his partner, Josie, whose favourite players are also Carlos and Ons. So Ed and Josie, you seem very well matched, and we wish you a wonderful time in Malaga, with the possibility of bumping into Matt Roberts. What more could a tennis fan want, Pam?
Did you say his last name was Bowling?
Yes. I said it with trepidation because I'm not 100% sure of the pronunciation. Bohling. So not exactly like
sounds
the sport.
Like his last...
Is bowling a sport?
Yeah, his last name should be tennis. Sort of. But I think that's an amazing email to write as a thank you. That was fantastic. Love it.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks, Pam. And well done, Ed. And enjoy your trip. Tickets to the Davis Cup finals in Malaga are now available from the official Davis Cup website, and a link to that can be found in our show notes. We have a mascot for this episode, and it is Doomy. Do you think I'm pronouncing that right, Matt? D-U-M-I.
Do.
You do. Thank you. Well, the alternative is Dummy, which it's not Dummy, is it? It's Doomy. Doomy. Doomy the Dachshund, owned by Christiane. Doomy is a two-year-old red standard Dachshund living in Berlin and on an island at the North Sea, which makes no sense to me, but sounds very exotic. Doomy is rarely expected from a dog of his size. Doomy, from the South African Zulu name Dumisani, meaning praise, is in training to be a man trailer to find missing people. Bred to chase badgers out of their burrows, Doomy is fearless, and what he's missing in size he makes up with in personality. As big as his snout is also his ego. They don't say for nothing. When a Dachshund looks in the mirror, he sees a lion, which is very Billie Jean energy. Since Billie Jean has a Dachshund friend, shout out to Neville, and seems to like these little sausages, Doomy would like to invite Billie Jean to Berlin for the 2024 Laver Cup to show her some dog parks and Berliner squirrels. Oh, wow. Well, Christiane, I would urge you to write to British Airways and urge them to change their dogs on planes policy, because we are one of the only nations to have a very strict no dogs on planes policy. I have looked into it. But hopefully that will change in the future, and Billie Jean can make another Dachshund friend. Doomy is absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous, and I'm very partial to a sausage dog. We have our mascots. David's got Maisie. No need to remind anybody what they achieved this week. I've got Xenia, and Matt has got Darwin. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our executive producers, Jamie, Hannah, Andrew, and Pam. Will you join us for some shout-outs?
Please. Yes, please.
Take it away, Matt.
I'm excited for this. We have great shout-outs today. We have four of them. We put out a call for people to get their shout-outs in this week, and we've been inundated with shout-outees, so we are now upping to four an episode until the end of the year. So we start with Saga Shriramagiri, who I met in New York. Saga is lovely. He lives in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Pam, we're relying on you for Hoboken material.
Well, it's right across the Lincoln Tunnel from the amazing Manhattan, and Hoboken. I believe Frank Sinatra is from Hoboken.
Very good.
Wow, Pam,
love that. Thank you, Saga.
We've also got Peter Figasinski, who is from Vancouver, and Peter says, I used to work for Matt's official sponsor, Wilson, as their lead graphic designer for their tennis rackets, including ones used by Roger and Serena, and of course, Grigor. And Peter has in the past sent us some fantastic stuff of Wilson gear that was designed but never used, you know, stuff like a special 24th Slam racket for Serena and a Tokyo Olympics racket for Roger Federer. So, yeah, I know Peter. That's a very cool job.
That's an awesome job.
It's interesting how you've mentioned both Vancouver, who hosted Laver Cup this year, and then Berlin, who has it next year.
Yes.
Mm. Thank you, Peter. We always mention Peter McNamara when we get a Peter shout-out. Any opportunity to mention Macca, what a guy he was. So thank you, Peter.
Mm. We've also got a happy birthday to Megan Moriarty,
What a name. Happy birthday, Megan.
There are some names. Megan Shaughnessy, Megan Markle. I know she's a good tennis player.
Megan Shaughnessy and Megan Markle, all the big Megans.
That is a shout-out birthday gift from her father, Michael. And Michael was a high school classmate of Chris Evert.
Michael?
Wow.
He's just dropped that in there.
In Fort Lauderdale, Florida. That's pretty amazing. Chrissy is about to have her 69th birthday December 29th. So that gives us an idea of the age of that shout-out person.
You've been outed, Michael.
Sorry, Michael. Michael Schick.
Thank you, Michael, and happy birthday, Megan.
And the final shout-out is for the first person to fill in the form when we requested new shout-outees, and that is David Whittaker.
Your dad.
He says...
Go on, Pam,
he gets a few mentions during the year.
He says, I didn't understand podcasts for a long time, and it wasn't until the tennis podcast had been going for 3 or 4 years that I twigged. Now I listen to podcasts all the time, and of course to every edition of the tennis podcast.
Love it. Nothing like family.
What he's saying there, Pam, is that his daughter made a podcast every week and daily during Grand Slams on his favourite subject for 6 years, and he didn't listen, but has now changed his ways and is a very big fan, and that's great. Better late than never, Dad. Thank you. I love that he filled out the form.
Within seconds.
Thank you, Dad. I can't say thank you, David. Too weird. You can say thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Dad. Pam, thank you. It is always such a tremendous pleasure. Next time we see you, we will be on a barge in Melbourne, all of us.
Perfect. And I will be better prepared for January than I was for this podcast. Thanks for getting me out of my parenting trenches and back into the tennis talk. It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
From one trench to another. Pam, it is always such a pleasure. Matt, thank you. We don't need David. But we will gladly have him back. We'll be back when?
I think you and I are doing a post-WTA Finals group stage roundup. Either Friday night or Saturday morning. TBC.
TBC. Well, we'll be back to round up the group stages. And then, of course, we'll be back again to round up the semis and finals and goings-on in Paris. So we'll see you. We'll hear from you. No, you'll hear from us. It's going brilliantly, isn't it? Maybe we do need David back. You'll hear from us again over the weekend. Thank you, Pam. Thank you, Matt. Thank you for listening. We'll speak to you soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more. Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.